I also was thinking about, as I was considering this week, the sermon and the topic, something about there being something deeper, something that goes beyond the surface. And I recalled back when our Bucks County Symphony was having a rehearsal a couple of years ago, preparing for Dvorak's New World Symphony, which so many of us know and love. And at the end of the second movement, it features a melody line that's come to be known as going home. Da, 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 da. And the final chord, though, is rather unique because it's played by the bass section, only by the string bass section. It's a five-part harmony with string basses being played by seven basses. And after playing the chord, our conductor simply stopped in the rehearsal and he looked forward and he said slowly something like, "With all the turmoil in this world and being bombarded by stressful news and uncertainty, when you hear something that incredibly beautiful, it just gives you the strength and the will to go on and to know that there is so much more." And it was just an amazing moment. It was another one of those sacramental moments. I think that's the heart of the readings for this morning. What they're really talking about is realizing the divine, that amazingly beautiful presence of God within our routine daily existence and in the midst of all the ebb and flow of life. And when we do realize that, it puts everything else, everything petty, everything unhealthy or temporary in its place, its rightful place. And we move on as changed people, and because we're changed people, we thereby live in a changed world. And there was one other incredibly exciting thing about that moment with the orchestra. The orchestra applauded the bass section. That never happens. So I always will remember it. Our reading from Matthew, one that we shared on Tuesday morning with a great deal of energy. When Jesus entered the temple, and this was following the day following his entry into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, when Jesus entered the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people came up to him as he was teaching, and they said, "By what authority are you doing these things, and who gave you this authority?" And Jesus said to them, "I will also ask you one question. If you tell me the answer, then I will also tell you by what authority I do these things. Did the baptism of John the Baptist come from heaven, or was it from human origin?" And they argued with themselves, with one another, "If we say from heaven, he will say to us, 'Then why did you not believe him?' But if we say of human origin, we are afraid of the crowd because they all regard John as a prophet." And so they answered Jesus, "We do not know." And Jesus said to them, "Well, neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things." Jesus had a great sense of irony and humor. Then Jesus went on, as he often did, into a parable. It was a teachable moment. "What do you think? A man had two sons. He went to the first and he said, 'Son, go and work in the vineyard today.' And the son answered, 'I will not.' But later he changed his mind and he went. The father went to the second son and said the same, and he answered, 'I go, sir.' But he did not go. Which of the two," Jesus asked them, "did the will of his father?" And they said, the first one." Jesus said to them, "Truly, I tell you, the tax collectors and prostitutes are going into the kingdom of God ahead of you. For John came to you in the way of righteousness, and you did not believe him. But the tax collectors and the prostitutes did believe him. And even after you saw it, you did not change your minds and believe him." May God bless this reading from the Gospel of Matthew to us, for this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You know, this was supposed to be an easy sermon. I'll be truthful with you. I mean, this was a pretty straightforward encounter of Jesus with the temple authorities, a pretty straightforward parable. You know, here comes Jesus. He's ready. He's got a pithy parable. He's really going to sock it to those pompous Pharisees. Go, Jesus. This is going to be so easy. And, you know, we all surely enjoy a good put-down of the self-righteous, don't we? Oh, come on, admit it. And then there you have Paul's words to his beloved congregation at Philippi, which stands as one of the truly great passages of pastoral guidance to be had in the New Testament. As much as Jesus lowered the self-righteous, Paul's words lifted up those who truly were struggling to be righteous, to be just. Alas, only in Star Wars is it so easy to tell the good guys from the bad guys. And even in Star Wars, Darth Vader at the last moment has a change of heart, doesn't he? So it's not quite so easy. Jesus' reaction to the Pharisees was not, as some think, one of anger or of hatred. Jesus was driven by something much deeper to keep pushing them the way that he did. He was confronting them not in anger, but in frustration and in an anguish to help them to see clearly their own ways. He invoked the memory of John the Baptist to them out of a deep sadness that they were such prisoners of their own piety and practice. If Jesus had sensed no spiritual potential in those Pharisees, he would not have even bothered with them. But he did. He knew it was there. And the Apostle Paul, who loved the Philippian church so much, even so, he was frightened for them, that they might be tempted to embrace the spiritual one-upmanship that he had experienced in some other churches that he had started. This means you, Corinthians. His comment in verse 3 about selfishness or conceit indicates that they too were beginning to compare. They were beginning to compare what they wore, what they gave in offerings, which one of them prayed the most, which of them prayed the loudest. And so even if this message from Paul and Jesus remains on a surface level of the passages we've shared, and if we take them completely to heart on a surface level, that alone would change our lives, wouldn't it? But there's so much more here. There's more here that's seeking to change not only our lives, but also to change our world. You know, with all the exposure that we've had on TV and books and business, we constantly hear about the power of attitude, of the motivational payoff of a positive go-getter attitude. It's characteristic that positive attitude often can become its own answer, its own cure, in that having a positive attitude can point our eyes to be open to options that were previously overlooked. And once taken, problems can be solved. But often, both positive attitude and also religion are treated like a part-time option in busy, successful lives in society, until the unexpected then jars one to seek support or to seek answers. We need to recognize that in our country and in our community, people like us generally have many, many options. Now, we may not think that we sometimes do have a lot of options, because some of those options require changes that can be bothersome, yes, true, but the options are there. They're still there. But few of us face the physical dangers of hunger, of war, of homelessness, of repression that so many in the world face, and even of physical disasters and storms. Except in those instances when tragedy does strike us and no solution can change that reality, positive attitude, let's be honest, serves us pretty well, almost as much as religion, for change. And it may, for many people, become a substitute for religion. Let's just be positive. Let's follow the latest technique. what Jesus is saying and Paul was admonishing is that the believer accept the mind of Christ within themselves. Not just an attitude that's positive, but a merger of Christ's mind with our own. Now, of course, we may be prone to say, well, of course, yes, that sounds great, let's do it. But we need to think, what are really the consequences of accepting the mind of Christ? To have the mind of Christ means to adopt an attitude that truly submits to the will of God and of God's influences over our own. To have Christ's mind within our own mind can cause us to substitute eternal purposes for temporary advantages. Having the mind of Christ means, first of all, a conscious effort to make faith in God the central theme of our self-understanding, to form a definition of ourselves that reflects that there is a larger purpose in this human existence, one based and centered upon an infinite personal God, rather than a universe centered around us. So many persons, including those within the church, never find a meaning to embrace because they continue to look for God in a single event or a person or a problem or an aspect of a church instead of seeing the whole picture, which is God. There's an account that a boy once wandered into the Sistine Chapel just at the time that the great Michelangelo was painting the ceiling. And the boy asked him, what are you doing? And he said, I'm painting the noblest painting in history. And the boy said, it doesn't look that noble to me. And Michelangelo screamed at him, stolto ragazzo, foolish boy, get out. But when Michelangelo came down to the floor, there was a guard that pointed out, with all the scaffolding and the claws, the boy on the floor could only see God's fingernail. How could he grasp the grand design, he asked. And Michelangelo repeated, how could he grasp the grand design? And then he said, how can any of us grasp the grand design? By the time that many of us look for God or look to God, the events of life, like the scaffolding, have obscured so much that only a fingernail is sometimes visible. And just as quickly as we look, it seems that God is impotent to our need. It is when we seek to know God personally that we understand the grand design as a purpose and as a solution for human existence, that we can then interact with life in a truly different way. Everything that we do and know ceases to be couched in the temporary. And the events and the needs that are crucial are approached with confidence that the eternal exists. Someone once told me, the time to develop faith is before you need it. I keep reminding myself of that when my life seems to be coasting. And when there are sudden events, I think I've learned to pay attention. Today will be no exception. Friends, most of us here believe that a church should be a truly, awesomely active, constantly stretching in mission, educating itself in religious traditions and motivating theologies, caring and embracing of members, healing real hurts. Those are all wonderful things for us to be as a church. But that is not our first purpose. Because we can still do all those wonderful things and we can still be terrific pietistic Pharisees. Sincere, but lacking. And we can be fresh and eager to have community with one another and all those gifts of which the Apostle Paul teaches us, and we can still scare Paul silly that we are such a fragile, self-centered community. What a difference it makes, though, when we understand that our purpose is to have the mind of Christ first and foremost, and to bring it with us to church. A little contrast. Mr. John Jones went to church on Sunday. He heard the organist miss a note in the prelude, and he winced. He saw a child squirming where everyone was supposed to be bowed in prayer. He felt an usher watching him, he believed, to see what he put in the collection plate. It made him boil. He caught five grammatical errors in the sermon. And he slipped out through a side door during the closing hymn, muttering, "Never again. What a bunch of clods and hypocrites." Now, Mr. John Smith went to church, the same church, that morning too. He heard the organist play an arrangement of A Mighty Fortress, and it thrilled him to the depths to hear the majesty of it. He heard a small child squirming, and he was so glad that children were welcome to come to worship. He was thankful for an opportunity to share in a special offering for a visiting missionary. He listened especially to the sermon because it answered a question he'd been asking for a long time. And as Mr. John Smith walked out the door, he thought to himself, how can any person enter this place and not feel God? The answer, Mr. Smith, is by entering and not expecting to feel God. There are going to be times in the lives of each of us when we have particularly rough times or tragic events. And our first response to God will be the first son's response. No, I won't go. I won't accept your love. I won't believe that there is God's love and mercy in this awful world. But if we've practiced having the mind of Christ in the level times, the hills and valleys of life will find us able to turn back to God and to do God's will and to accept God's love. If accepting the mind of Christ has been something that you have put off until a time when in your life you feel, well, now I need religion, you will likely refuse the transplant when you need a better frame of mind. The mind of Christ is a powerful attitude to have. Seek to have it. Seek to live it in this, our church, and in these days. Let us be in prayer. Excuse us, dear Lord, but having your mind seems somewhat strange, that we might give over what little control we seem to have of life. But you are not trying to dictate our living, but to enrich it with an eternal purpose worth living for, and for some in this world even dying for. Come into us, Lord, give us your eyes and your hands and your mind, making us grow in faith and in hope and in love, now and always. Amen.